from Madrasa to modern erudition. As were with a whole host of figures among Iran's cultural elite of the period, Mohammad Ghazvini, 1877 to 1949, was a hybrid scholar between traditional madrasa education and modern Orientalist scholarship. A literary expert, bibliographer, and editor of classical texts, Ghazvini held sway over a generation of Iranian literary scholars. He started out as a young seminarian with a remarkable command of Arabic and a meticulous literary taste for classical Persian. Later, he developed an aptitude for the kind of Orientalist discipline that had fascinated him over the 35 years he spent in European libraries and manuscript collections. He viewed the mission of Iranian scholars as one of textual studies, critical editing, and a Renaissance-like unearthing of Iranian heritage. Among many works, he co-edited with Ghassem Ghani the Divan of Hafez, which helped reaffirm the poet's place in the Persian literary canon as a favourite bard of nearly all Iranians. The greatest methodological influence on Ghazvini, and a host of his cohorts, was the English Orientalist Edward Granville Brown. Contrary to the stereotypical image of an Orientalist, Brown was an exceptional blend of 19th-century romanticism, literary and historical scholarship, and anti-imperialist advocacy. His four-volume The Literary History of Persia, written between 1902 and 1924, chronicled a millennium of Persian literature with vigour and originality, setting the field against a panorama of political and cultural developments. His editing and publications, which included important Persian classics, were complemented by his encouragement and support for the likes of Ghazvini and Mohammad Iqbal Lahuri, 1877 to 1938. It is wrong to assume, however, that the discourse of Orientalism was one way. The movement to publish texts spearheaded by Brown owed much to a complex interplay between the Orientalist, who was equipped with tools of modern methodology and print culture, and learned scholars from Iran, Hindustan, and elsewhere, who had mastered bibliographic and paleographic skills. Beyond the work of Brown, the narrative of Persian cultural endurance against hostile forces of nomadic invasions and an imposed religion is also evident in new readings of Iran's pre-Islamic past. This Orientalist scholarship and the state's support for new archaeological expeditions emphasized the Achaemenid Empire of the 6th to 4th century BCE as Iran's moment of civilizational inception, and the Zoroastrianism revival of the Sasanian era in late antiquity as a moment of rebirth. Such reorientation in Iran's historical narrative from traditional historiography in the 19th century to modern incorporation of the pre-Islamic past was slow and complex. Beginning in the Qajar era, early accounts, such as Jalal ad-Din Mirza's Nameye Hosravan and later Aga Khan Kermani's Aineh-e Sekandari, Alexandrian Mirror, A History of Ancient Iran, struggled to bridge the ancient past to the Islamic past by reconciling the Shahnameh legends with modern archaeology, Greek and Latin texts, and Western scholarship. The Constitutional Revolution and its aftermath further inspired intellectuals to seek a soothing alternative, not only in classical Persian literature, but also in attention to ancient Iranian past. Hassan Pirnaz's reissued History of Ancient Iran, completed in 1933, proved a boost to the Pahlavi state's legitimacy and its claim to the ancient Persian past. Beyond the traditional Persian sources, Iranians for the first time were learning about the might of the Persian Empire, its expanse and its conquests, its administrative and civil organizations, and its commercial and cultural exchanges with Greek and Roman worlds through archaeology, as well as through ancient Greek, Roman, and Byzantine sources and modern Western scholarship. The vital link that Iran created for more than a millennium between civilizations of the East, China and South Asia in particular, and the Mediterranean world, through trade, economy, administration, and culture, and contributions of Zoroastrianism, Manichaeism, and Iranian languages, were reassuring signs of endurance and hope for renewal. The 1934 millennial celebration of Ferdowsi's Shahnameh, which brought to Iran scholars from around the world, and the completion of Ferdowsi's mausoleum by Iranian architect Karim Taherzadeh Behzad, which had started in 1928, proved important markers on Iran's map of cultural history. Public display of cultural symbols and the commemoration of Iranian literary and intellectual icons such as Ferdowsi and later Ibn Sina made the Iranian nationalist narrative to gradually trickle down to the level of the general public. Even men and women outside the immediate reaches of the state, clerical classes in the mosques and the madrasas, the merchants of the bazaar, and villagers and nomads in remote parts of the country, began to adjust to the standardized Persian language and the Persian cultural symbols and historical narrative, even though some consciously resisted the state's monopoly over what constituted Iranian and the homogenizing policies employed to implement it. Ibrahim Pourdavoud, 1885-1968, can be regarded as a key scholar responsible for incorporating ancient Iranian languages and texts into the Pahlavi nationalism. Another product of the madrasa in Rasht, his eventful life took him during the 1910s and 1920s to Lebanon, Paris, Berlin, and Mumbai. His studies over 3 decades ranged from Shi'i jurisprudence, Arabic grammar, and traditional medicine to the study of law in France and Germany and learning a host of European languages. During World War I, he joined the Berlin Circle and returned to Kermanshah as an agent provocateur. There he co-edited with Jamalzadeh the anti-occupation journal Rastakhiz, Resurrection. On his return to Berlin, and as part of the nationalist discourse of the Berlin Circle during the Weimar years, he was involved in the study of Zoroastrianism and ancient Iranian languages, and came to know a number of important German and later French, English, and American Iranists. The experience profoundly transformed Pourdavoud. He later moved to India, where he collaborated with Parsi scholars to translate Avesta from original Avestan into Persian. On his return to Iran in 1937, he was appointed as Professor of Ancient Iranian Languages at Tehran University. In his life and his scholarship, during which he trained generations of students in Tehran University, Pourdavoud, like Bahar and Ahmad Khasravi, clearly displayed the shift from the activism of the constitutional era to Iranian nationalist discourse of the Pahlavi period. Unraveling an Ancient Pact. Awareness of Zoroastrianism and revival of the ancient Iranian memories incited a challenge to the whole project of Pahlavi secularism on the side of the Shi'i clerical establishment. Even though in the earlier years of Pahlavi rule, relations with the Alama classes were relatively amicable and mutually beneficial, by the late 1920s and throughout the 1930s, a widening rift had begun to occur with lasting consequences. Even before the rise of Reza Khan, a marked decline was evident in clerical prestige, symbolized by the 1909 execution of Sheikh Fazlollah Nuri. By 1939, a generation later, the introduction of new dress codes and mandatory unveiling culminated the state's success in undermining the conservative mores and values of the clerical establishment and its loyal following. The secularizing agenda, conceived and enforced largely by the Pahlavi cultural elite and overseen by the Shah himself, further eroded an ancient social accord that tied, at least in theory, the good government with the good religion, the inseparable twins, as they were known to classical authors. This was a principle that had been in operation in one form or another since the Sasanian era, and since the Safavid times had defined socio-political norms. The unravelling of this pact, an inevitable outcome of the state's secularizing policies, proved more potent than subduing the tribal countryside or keeping at bay European imperial ambitions. In due course, the experiences of the Reza Shah era transformed the Shi'i clerical establishment into a force of political dissent. Earlier signs of a widening gap between the Pahlavi regime and the clerical class had appeared in 1927, with the compulsory military service for all males, including students of the madrasa. The Ulama of Isfahan, who feared that the godless Pahlavi military was brainwashing Muslim youth, called for resistance but rallied little popular support, their appeal quickly withered. Likewise, other reform measures carried out by the state, such as introducing a westernized dress code for men, de-emphasizing and eventually eliminating religious education from schools' curricula, and even the government's greater control over charitable endowments, did not result in mass support in favor of the clergy. The real test, however, came in the 1935 protest in various cities against the compulsory unveiling of women. In Mashhad, popular demonstrations led to a bloody scene in the Gauharshad Mosque, adjacent to the shrine of the 8th Imam, where provocations of Sheikh Muhammad Taghi Bolul, approximately 1900 to 2005, a low-ranking, rabble-rousing preacher, led to the mob lynching of a government official. In response, security forces indiscriminately opened fire on protesters, killing more than a dozen and injuring a few hundred more. The ominous incident signaled not only the state's audacity in violating the sanctuary of an important mosque, but also the ulama's futile objections. Reza Shah and the Pahlavi elite categorically regarded the clerical establishment and what it stood for as an impediment to progress, and sought to reduce it in size and substantially emasculate its influence among the conservative bazaar sector. To further weaken opposition voices among the ulama, the Pahlavi government also adopted a conciliatory course toward moderates. Despite restrictions on preaching in the mosques and donning clerical attire, the state never dismantled the clerical hierarchy or the institution of the madrasa, the waqf, and other means of revenue. Remarkably, in the early Pahlavi era, although the number of madrasas decreased, Qom acquired greater visibility as a clerical center. A majority of moderate ulama succumbed to the diminishing status of their class with a mix of resignation and remorse, the latter for not fighting hard enough for Qajar survival. They viewed Reza Shah and Pahlavi modernizing as an inevitable, even a necessary evil, so long as the residue of their clerical power remained in place. Unlike the Sunni clerical institutions in other Muslim lands, which for centuries were under the aegis of the Ottoman state, the Shi'i Iranian ulama had maintained their institutional independence even after the demise of the Qajars. Even if they lost Pahlavi patronage and the unwritten contract with the state was about to be abrogated, their group solidarity was not entirely lost. As it turned out, the immediate hardships imposed on them added to overall clerical resilience and their rebound after Reza Shah. Many members of the cultural elite, the influential culture minister Ali Asghar Hekmat, 1893 to 1980, the nationalist historian Ahmad Kasravi, and the polemical journalist Ali Dashti, 1896 to 1982, for instance, themselves were products of the madrasa and felt a certain affinity with their educational past, especially when faced with the brutish Pahlavi army officers or with the hedonistic conduct of such powerful statesmen as Temur Tash. Yet the westernizing Pahlavi culture could not help but mock the arcane mentality and demeanor of the clergy. The nationalist narrative, moreover, marginalized and even belittled the experience of Iranian Shi'ism as an unfortunate historical aberration, an affliction. To the extent that Shi'ism was incorporated into this national narrative, in school textbooks or state propaganda, the potent Shi'i story was diluted into a facile history of the Imams. Even the role of Shi'ism in the rise of Safavids and as an important element of national identity was downplayed. It was valued and thus tolerated for being part of the Iranian identity that set it apart from the Arab and Turkish Sunnis. In this setting, the story of Hussein and Karbala and the rituals of Muharram were seen through a modernist prism as embarrassing symptoms of superstitious religiosity. Most displays of collective rituals were banned. Muharram processions with banners, flags, and other symbols, the recitation of morning liturgy, performance of taziyeh, passion plays, the self-punishing acts of chest-biting, chain-biting, wearing shrouds, inflicting wounds on one's forehead with a saber, ghameh zani, and piercing one's body with spikes and padlocks. Characteristic of its cultural hostility, the Pahlavi state even went on to demolish the magnificent Tekiyeh Dolat, a visible example of the Qajar tribute to Shi'ism. The destruction of this remarkable structure in the 1930s was replaced, tellingly, with a branch of the Iran National Bank built in a faux Persian style on the aforementioned Bozar-Jomeri Avenue. A rude reminder, no doubt, to the religiously minded bazaar merchants that the days of ritual Shi'ism were over. The quiet renouncing of the clergy on the charge of obscurantism further helped debase their public standing. And, from the modernist perspective, there was plenty to be critical of. The clergy's outmoded demeanour, their pseudo-Arabicized accent denoting their pride in long years of study in Najaf, their obsession with ritual purity and pollution, and above all, their aversion to all things Western. These offered opportunities to the modernist detractors to disparage at least the middle and lower clerical ranks as ignorant, flea-infested, starved mullahs raving for a handout or a session of Rose Juani. More damaging to their public image, however, was a brain drain that sapped the clerical ranks, pulling many into the government bureaucracy and state institutions. The new avenues to prestige, even if they meant a meagre but regular source of income, were enticing. A desk job in a government bureaucracy had gained a certain mystique because of the association with government, even though it was often as tedious as cramming the intricate rules of Arabic syntax in the madrasa. Becoming a civil servant, and hence being included in the machinery of government, meant success. Earning degrees in engineering or modern medicine, and engaging in business or teaching in modern schools, also attracted the younger generation, including the children of the ranking clergy, who saw little future for themselves in donning clerical garb when sources of clerical incomes were drying up. Journalism, practicing law, and even politics, and especially opportunities in the reformed judiciary as judges and advocates, were all alternatives for the best and the brightest. Above all, however, it was running the government-approved registry offices that provided a safe job. Conducting state-regulated marriage and divorce, drawing up official documents, deeds, and contracts, and serving as public notary. The judicial reforms under Davar, beginning in the winter of 1927 with the temporary dismantling of the existing Ministry of Justice and continuing throughout the Reza Shah era, introduced codified statutes and monitored judicial appointments. These measures diminished the clergy's reach in the judicial sphere and deprived the study of Islamic jurisprudence, fiqh, of nearly all its practical applications. The elaborate, though bookish and cumbersome, Shi'i law of contracts, ma'amelat, was no longer considered valid, even though the authors of the new statutory laws made ample use of it to adjust the French civil code to Shi'i contingencies. Nor were Shi'i roots of jurisprudence, a system at the core of the clerical profession, considered the sole source for civil or penal law. More important, interpretation of law and its enforcement were now squarely in the hands of state courts, and thus outside the traditional domain of the jurists. What was left unregulated, however, was the devotional and obligational aspect of the Sharia dealing with purity and pollutants, as well as rules on prayers, fasting, pilgrimage, alms, and other devotional acts. Such aspects, predictably, became the chief preoccupation of the ulama and received ample attention in a new genre of legal manuals known as Tawziya Masa'el, explication of legal problems, being catechisms and fatwas in response to real or hypothetical queries. These treatises, in due course, would become mandatory for leading ayatollahs who were recognized by the community or who wished to be recognized as a source of emulation, marja et taqlid. The judicial reforms under Davar put the final touch on a process that had begun with the constitutional revolution. Since the early Qajar era, the rise of the Mojtahids as a powerful interest group effectively barred any codification or universal enforcement of law through regulated courts. In contrast to the Ottoman Empire and Khedivate Egypt, especially after 1882, and Muslim law in colonial India, state intervention in the Qajar period was minimal and ineffective. Despite the impressive conceptual development of Shi'i jurisprudence and legal methodology, and despite half-hearted attempts by reformist administrations, the notion of a universal code applicable to all remained largely foreign to Iranians. The practice of law within a regulated judicial framework was held ransom by the ambiguities of the Sharia, contradictory interpretations of the mujtahids, the vagaries of their verdicts, arbitrary court procedures, and the jurists' notorious propensity for corruption and bribe-taking. The post-constitutional judicial reforms of various administrations set the stage for statutory legislation, but also helped complicate the situation by creating a parallel legal framework. The new Pahlavi legal reforms, primarily based on the Napoleonic Code, adopted the French system to reasonable dictates of the Shi'i Sharia, and did this perhaps more effectively than many other Muslim countries in the 20th century. Under Davin's supervision, a council of legal experts, consisting of middle-ranking mujtahids and state administrators of madrasa background who were familiar with European law, reviewed the French codes in a relatively short period of time, refashioning them according to Islamic contingencies. The 1927 Penal Code and the subsequent 1931 Civil Code replaced, in stages, the mujtahid-run Sharia courts. The new codes featured all the deficiencies of a state-dominated bureaucratic system, yet the Islamic provisions in the system proved vital for the state's legitimacy. The new statutory codes, rooted in the 1906 to 1907 Constitution, aimed to protect the rights of citizens, due process, and equality before the law. Yet the arbitrary rule of the Pahlavis, the passivity of a rubber-stamp legislature, the lack of public scrutiny, and the residue of the traditional legal culture posed serious obstacles. Family law, particularly issues of marriage, divorce, and custodianship, remained firmly congruent with the dictates of Islamic law and its patriarchal underpinnings, as did the laws of inheritance and, to a lesser extent, penalties for sexual offences and domestic violence. The law allowed for polygamy, though subordinated it to some conditions, and in general granted little protection to women beyond being wives and mothers in the traditional framework of Islamic law. Women's lives were ransomed to a variety of traditional deprivations and insecurities, with few incentives for legal, financial, or professional independence. The striking disregard for women's legal rights was often blamed by the Pahlavi reformers on the society's conservative values and fear of the ulama's opposition. Yet the Pahlavi modernizers were not devoid of a patriarchal mentality and were tainted by the European culture of male superiority of their time. The new reforms, moreover, obligated most upper and middle ranks of the clergy to be content with meagre incomes through registry bureaus, the fast diminishing income of the charitable endowments, waqfs, and the generosity of bazaar merchants. Their loss of income was further exacerbated by the bleak economy of the Depression era, which hit Iranian trade and agriculture, and by the mismanagement and corruption that had long beset the institution of waqf. Between 1927 and 1933, the passage of new laws gave the state custodianship of all public endowments, most significantly the extensive endowments of the shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad, and control of the private waqfs, presumed abandoned or with unknown trustees. State intervention also struck a blow to the incentives for creating new waqfs. Whereas in the past, creating a charitable foundation was a safe way to preserve control over family fortunes and avert state intrusion while performing an esteemed religious duty that was beneficial to the public, in the Pahlavi era, it came to be considered an outmoded, cumbersome institution of little significance. Bureaucratization of the waqf and failure to enforce effective supervision led to decay or the expropriation of many endowed kanats, bathhouses, water reservoirs, tekiyes, bridges, and libraries. Many villages, farms, and bazaar shops, which provided support for the upkeep of these public institutions, were also misappropriated or their potential diminished. Yet the clergy did not entirely lose their control. The government appointed many as custodians and set up pensions for others that were sufficient to let them carry on with their duties. Dress code, unveiling, and the clerical predicament. Even as the state's intervention into the judicial, educational, and economic domains was considerable, intrusion into citizens' private lives was the most glaring. The dress code of December 1928 required all male citizens, from school age onward, to dress in a European-style jacket and trousers and a short, cylindrical, rimmed hat, known as the pahlavi hat, similar to the French kepi. By the turn of the 20th century, selective westernization had made a wide range of European clothing fashionable among the urban elites. Yet Iranian society was still conscious of attire as a powerful social marker that determined social status, region, profession, communal loyalty, and even sexual orientation. The introduction of dress uniformity, with its militaristic undertones, was a radical departure from this landscape of apparel diversity, whereby mullahs, merchants, craftsmen, government functionaries, khans, peasants, dervishes, and lutis, as well as women of various social classes, the nomadic men and women of Iran's vast network of tribes and ethnicities, and religious minorities, were all identified not only by their dialect, but also by their distinctive appearance. Like the ideologies obsessed with uniforms in Europe and in neighbouring Turkey, the Pahlavi dress code was a powerful tool to transform Iranian society into a bland and featureless mass, amnesic of its diversity, and ready to be recast in a westernized mould. Reza Khan, a Savadku peasant who was transformed in the Cossack barracks into the Man of Destiny, was the prototype. Dressed in a plain military uniform, short cape in the style of Mussolini, and knee-high leather boots, he exuded power. Ordinary Iranian citizens, however, appeared frightened and awkward in their new, ill-fitting outfits. Even so, the swift currents of change were all embracing. For the ulama, the mandatory dress code was anathema, even though they were partially exempted from it. They resented the Pahlavi outfit, primarily because westernized uniformity was a symbolic statement against what they stood for. Besides fear that the rimmed hat was a deliberate move by the godless state to make it impossible for believers to prostrate during daily prayers, they considered the indignity of being subject to the state's qualifying criteria, which also included a written examination on the madrasa curriculum, made the clergy feel degraded and resentful. Losing the privilege to put on clerical attire, particularly from the mid-1930s as new restrictions began to take effect, meant that many could no longer be recognized outright as holy, as they had for centuries, solely by wearing a turban. Black for the presumed descendants of the House of the Prophet, a disproportionately high number among the clergy, and white for others. The turban, at times a dome-like structure made of layers of twisted cloth, was complemented by a robe, a abba, slippers, preferably yellow, and a loose cloak known as rada, items of clothing with a sacred lineage in the biographies of the Prophet and the Imams. A long, dyed beard, the scent of rosewater, green rosary beads, and at times a white or green shawl around the waist, were essential vestments that clashed with the prevailing exigencies of the profane state. Having been excluded from the mandatory dress code, the clergy stood out as a historical anomaly and were looked upon by the modernizing middle classes with condescension, if not disdain. More provocative than any other reform measure under Reza Shah, however, was the unveiling of women, the removal of both the facial hijab and the all-body chadar, first in selective venues, such as public gatherings organized by the government, and from 1934 as a mandatory state-enforced policy. What was at stake did not concern the ulama, but touched on a core issue of the society's mores and patriarchal identity. Women's cover and their social exclusion had been practiced since ancient times and assiduously since the early Qajar era in the male-controlled urban setting. Women's cover was seen as a symbol of male honour, Persian namus, from the Greek nomos, universal law, family virtue, and female sexual and moral chastity, considered building blocks of the social universe and its strict maintenance through rules of reproduction, lineage, and gender boundaries. It was this order that was challenged. Yet it is naive to assume that unveiling was a Pahlavi invention ex nihilo. Besides the Babi legacy and memories of Tahereh Garat al-Ain, Some 70 years earlier, the progressive constitutionalist press and poets of the period, Aref Ghazvini and Iraj Mirza, 1874 to 1926, among others, and a handful of women's journals after 1910, called for women's inclusion in the Iranian national discourse through education, control over their own lives, combating legal discrimination, and emancipation from social depravities. Aref called upon regiments of women combatants to fight along with the poet against superstition and tyranny. In a famous piece from the late 1910s, Iraj masterfully satirized the bigotry of his clerical contemporaries. Once a female image was carved on the portal of a caravansarai, presumably in Mashhad. The news soon reached the masters of turbans, who rushed to the scene. Worried that the unveiled image would instantaneously wipe out the believer's faith, the seminarians, tollab, soon imposed on the image a makeshift veil. The honour, namus, that was about to be weathered thus was saved with a handful of dirt. Now the ulama could rest assured, Iraj sneered, that female seduction no longer could sink the public into an ocean of sin, and the undisturbed nomos barred all hell from breaking loose. With such zealous ulama, he concluded, why are our people still gloomy about progress in our kingdom? In the aftermath of Reza Khan's rise to power, and especially during the debate over republicanism, support for unveiling grew as women's groups organized and demonstrated, casting off their veils and clashing with opponents. But it was after 1927 that sporadic voluntary unveiling was visible among Tehran's elite. By 1932, unveiling was encouraged for schoolgirls and for wives and daughters of military officers and civil servants. By 1934, in the aftermath of Reza Shah's official visit to Turkey, the only foreign visit he ever made, the new government decree required nationwide mandatory unveiling among all classes. The rigorous enforcement of the new policy, which continued up to the end of the Reza Shah era, meant that women belonging even to the most conservative families were to remove their veils and chadar. Carefully monitored by the Shah himself, the universal enforcing of unveiling was not free of social tension. Ugly scenes of the police forcefully removing women's chadars in the streets, reprimands and sacking of military and civilian officials who were reluctant to abide by the new policy, and general disregard for conservative sentiments against unveiling cast a shadow over the whole episode. Yet, contrary to a common perception that mandatory unveiling was unpopular and oppressive, its liberating effects were undeniable. A large sector of the female population, especially younger women, welcomed unveiling with the same enthusiasm as they welcomed modern education, participation in public life, and greater control over their lives. It is telling that after 1941, when mandatory enforcement was quickly abandoned, only a fraction of urban women, mostly in smaller cities and among the more religious classes, took up chadar again, and almost none, even wives and daughters of the clergy, readopted the facial veil, niqab. This was in clear contrast to the universal use of facial covering for women before 1927, as imposed invariably in all Muslim societies of the time. The generational divide also played a part. Older women, who, in compliance with the requirement of the Sharia, had seldom, if ever, ventured out from the inner quarter, andarun, of their houses, opted to stay inside for good, out of fear of the dishonour that casting off of their niqab and chadar might bring to them. The younger generations, however, were far more willing to cast aside the suffocating traditional mould. Violent enforcement aside, the unveiling was simultaneously a credit to Reza Shah's secularization program and a loss to the clergy's prestige. Intimidated and unsure, the clergy had little choice but to accept the reality in silence. No major fatwa against unveiling was issued at the time, though in later years there was ample resentment toward enforcement of the hijab. Even families of modest means soon began to adapt to the unveiled appearance and acquire sentiments that were unmistakably modern. Opposition to unveiling was symptomatic of the clerical failure to forge an alternative to the Pahlavi model. The jurist establishment conceivably could have addressed, but never did, the predicaments of the Sharia the arcane teaching methods, the textbooks and the curriculum, and the conservative worldview associated with them. It was as if the ulama within the madrasa walls remained unperturbed and in a state of denial, despite a revolution that had shaken their very social foundations. The shrinking of the clerical horizons had begun long ago, when they rebuffed alternative modes of thinking, even something as benign as Islamic philosophy, and rejected innovation, bid'at, as heretical, even within the well-guarded bounds of jurisprudence, instead augmenting the fundamentals of their legal corpus as sacred and thus unchallengeable. Even such mild revisionist traits emerging on the margins of the clerical community, as in the views of Muhammad Hassan Shariat Sangelaji, 1892-1944, who were roundly condemned by the mainstream as sacrilegious. Himself emerged ahead. Sangelaji proposed, to the dismay of his detractors, a rational approach to Sharia that aimed to accommodate some measure of modernity in theology and law compatible with the legal reforms of the Pahlavi era. He called for an unambiguous reading of the Quran as a window to a new jurisprudence that was not obfuscated by the dubious hadith, scholastic convolution, and popular superstition. His rationalistic approach, blended with elements of Salafism and Messianism, brought Sangelaji to the point of rejecting the literal Shi'i narrative of the hidden imam's violent and vengeful khuruj, apocalyptic return. He opted instead for a gradual transformation of the community, a view that brought him somewhat close to the Baha'i idea of moral reconstruction. The proximity may explain his antagonism toward the Baha'is and his anxiety over increasing numbers of conversion to the new faith. The ulama remained equally unmoved by lay critics such as Ahmad Kasravi, 1890-1946, the influential journalist and prophet of moral reconstruction in the 1930s and 1940s. Blissfully proud of their heritage, they brushed off critiques of their theology and jurisprudence in the same way they reacted to the Baha'i missionaries, Mobalegs, whom they viewed as their gravest doctrinal enemies, and later to socialists and to Islamic modernists. Such predicaments of Islamic law and theology as denying equal rights to all citizens, regardless of gender and creed, intolerance toward non-Muslims, non-Shi'is and religious dissenters, institutional and legal discrimination of women, sanctioning of such punishments as stoning, vengeance killing, gesas, blood retribution, punishment of homosexuality, and execution of sexual offenders and heretics, denial of freedom of speech and the press, obstinate anti-intellectualism, and the assumption of an elevated status for the clerical elite, all these remained unresolved. The shrinking social domain of the Shi'i clerical class was undeniable, and so was the greater cleavage between the modern and traditional sectors of Iranian society. The clerical community who survived doctrinal challenges, the state's secularizing policies, and counter-incentives of the economic market, became more conscious of itself as a deprived and persecuted community. Qom, more than older theological centers such as Isfahan and Mashhad from the late 1920s, came to represent this ethos of isolation, most starkly evident in the impoverished life of the students of the madrasa. For the most part, they were dependent on pensions from the marjas, handouts from mourning societies, to recite eulogies at the roza sessions during Muharram and Ramadan, and alms distributed by pilgrims to the Shi'i shrines in Iran and southern Iraq. The clergy also lost ground in the public forum against the media and entertainment. The establishment of a small government radio station in 1927, later to be expanded to a more powerful broadcast as Radio Iran in 1940, and the growing number of theatres and cinemas in the capital and later in the provinces through 1930s and 1940s, were competition for sessions of Roze Khwani and preaching in the mosques. Hollywood movies, early Persian films produced in Mumbai, and the introduction of gramophones and recordings of Persian classical and popular music opened new avenues for leisure, though roundly condemned as blasphemous by the ulama. From the early 20th century, the growing production of discography for the Iranian market made various genres of Persian music, classical and popular, accessible to an eager public. They gave Persian music and musicians a new public forum, different from parties in nobility's houses and revelry in the lowly taverns on city outskirts. By the late 1930s, there were at least three Western recording companies and their Iranian subsidiaries producing in London, Istanbul, Baku, Tashkent, and later in Tehran recordings that captured the best of the Persian music ensembles and vocal performances, both male and female. The Iranian public came to admire such composers and virtuosos as Darvish Khan, 1872-1926, who recorded the Persian Dastgah system on tar, and the celebrated female singer Gamar al-Mulukch Vaziri, 1905-1959. These lent to Persian music a new aura of prestige and respectability. Patriotic anthems and popular songs, comical parodies, and popular comedies were also released. Western films introduced dashing male movie stars in exotic costumes, glamorous actresses, spectacular epics, slapstick, westerns, and Hollywood melodramas, with growing appeal to the younger public. Cafes and restaurants, a novelty for the upper classes in the capital, also offered a secular ambiance. For ordinary Iranians, the traditional coffee houses, now almost exclusively serving tea and inexpensive bazaar dishes, remained a venue for listening to storytellers, nagals, narrating tales of the Shahnameh and other classical and popular texts. With the growth of modern entertainment, storytelling in coffeehouses and by wandering dervishes, who displayed large-scale paintings as visual aids for their narratives of the Shi'i tragedies and the Shahnameh stories, gradually disappeared. The Shi'i ulama no longer objected to or approved of these forms of public entertainment as they had in the 17th century. They had other displays of heathen leisure to worry about. Many among the ulama and their conservative followers avoided radio broadcasts altogether and did not even own a receiver, on the grounds that possessing a medium that broadcasts music is religiously unlawful. The end of Reza Shah's regime. By the mid-1930s, Reza Shah's regime had turned increasingly oppressive and unpredictable. The old elite had been cowed into submission, and in time was replaced by a new generation of technocrats. The army generals were subdued to the Shah's whims and wishes. The clergy were demoralized and in retreat. The majlis was reduced to a non-entity. The tribes, by and large, were pacified, and their leadership eliminated or exiled. And a police apparatus, including a vast number of secret agents, became a vicious tool of the Shah's paranoid fears. Despite the appearance of absolute power, however, the popular base for the Pahlavi order had been eroded and its legitimacy questioned. World War II made these cracks more obvious, and the foreign policy quagmire in which Iran found itself unfathomable. In August 1941, Reza Shah was forced to abdicate, and Iran was occupied by Britain and Russia for the second time in 25 years. The irony of this was borne out by the Iranian people with a mix of cynicism and despair. At the outset of World War II in August 1939, Iran declared neutrality, as it had done in 1915, but, as it turned out, with no effect. Suspicious of Reza Shah's true intentions, and concerned with the sizable German presence in Iran, as early as January 1940, Britain began mobilizing a British Indian force with the intention of occupying the oil fields of Khuzestan. Given the vitality of Iranian oil for the British economy and war efforts, Reza Shah's 1933 renegotiation of the oil concession made British authorities even more suspicious, especially after Winston Churchill's ascendancy in May 1940 as Prime Minister of Britain. His unabashed hegemonic sentiments took on a new patriotic ring and resonated through the British diplomatic ranks. The British minister in Tehran, Reda Bullard, a diplomat with profound colonial biases, qualified his condescension toward Iranians with concerns for Reza Shah's collaboration with the Nazis and thereby the threat of German infiltration in Iran. Even before 1933 and the rise of the National Socialist Party to power in Germany, Iran relied on German technical and financial expertise for building new industries, railroad construction, the banking system, and training the workforce at a German-run technical school. German industrial ascendancy from the early 1930s made that country an attractive choice for Iran's trade and industry and a willing partner. Hoping to be on the side of the winner and reap the potential benefits, in August 1939, at the outset of the war, the Shah appointed as the new premier the French-educated Ahmad Matin Daftari, 1891-1971, who was known for his Germanophile tendencies. The memories of German support in World War I for the Iranian nationalists were reinforced by Nazi propaganda, highlighting the presumed common Aryan origins of the German and Iranian peoples. The change of the country's official name in European languages in 1935, from Persia to Iran, was a gesture of nationalist assertion, implying Iran's rebirth. In the Persian language, the country's name always was Iran, at least since the 3rd century CE. Yet the Pahlavi decision to use a new nomenclature abroad may have been influenced by the etymological association between Iran and Aryan, undermining 2.5 millennia of historical and cultural memories associated with the name Persia. The ultra-nationalist officials and military officers in the Pahlavi service argued that the old nomenclature projected an image of weakness and subservience abroad. In reality, such an argument was grounded less in a desire to pay homage to Iran's ethnic and regional diversity than in raw nationalist sentiments. The fear of British retaliation over ties with Germany, however, soon persuaded Reza Shah to change course and even proposed to the British a secret defence pact and proposal for military assistance, primarily to withstand what seemed an imminent incursion by the Soviet Union, then an ally of Germany, into the Iranian territory. London turned down both proposals. Mindful of the impending British occupation of the southern oil fields, in June 1940, in the midst of uncertainty about the fate of the war, out of desperation, the Shah even sacked and arrested his premier, Matin Daftari, and replaced him with an Anglophile, Ali Mansour, 1886-1974, a move that unleashed the wrath of Nazi Germany and its sympathisers. Though a group of German residents, numbering 1,000, were working in Iran, Radio Berlin's Persian broadcast, the first of foreign broadcasts beamed to Iran, began to attack Reza Shah as a British stooge and anticipate his forthcoming downfall. The forecast, which enjoyed a wide listening audience, gave further credence to the popular fear of a pro-German coup while diminishing the Shah's stature in the public eye. A rapid sequence of events, almost fatefully, terminated Reza Shah's effort to balance the two powers and sealed his political fate. Early in 1941, the pro-German coup led by Rashid Ali Gaylani was staged in neighbouring Iraq. Its subsequent collapse in late May, once British forces captured Basra and Baghdad, underscored the possibility of a similar hazard being perpetrated against Iran's fragile sovereignty. Gaylani and his cohorts fled to Iran in early June, presumably on their way to Germany, a move that added to the British suspicion of Reza Shah's pro-Axis sentiments. The invasion of Syria and Lebanon, too, by a joint operation of the British and the Free French forces, further drove home the message of an impending threat to Iran. Yet what ended for good Reza Shah's time on the throne was the Grand Anglo-Soviet Alliance after Hitler's decision to invade Russia, his former ally, in June 1941. The Grand Alliance, backed by American support under the Atlantic Charter, was reminiscent of the World War I Anglo-Russian Alliance. Likewise, the survival of both powers in war against their nemesis once more was destined to wreck Iran's political and social stability. Even though Britain and Russia gave assurances that they would respect Iran's territorial integrity, in what seemed a predetermined course, both powers, in July 1941, submitted an ultimatum demanding the immediate expulsion of all German nationals in the service of the Iranian government. Although earlier Iran had reasserted its neutrality in this new phase of the conflict, as did Turkey, and promised to ask all non-essential German civilians to leave, and even though Berlin intensified its attacks on Reza Shah on the airwaves, the signs of open Anglo-Soviet hostility were not abating. The Red Army began to amass troops along Iran's northern border, while the British Broadcasting Corporation began to heighten its criticism of Reza Shah's tyranny and his amassing of a huge fortune through misappropriation of land, especially in Mazandaran province. that the BBC championed the liberal and constitutional cause in Iran was a surprise shift from its earlier condoning of many years of the Shah's autocratic rule, no doubt with a clear goal of inciting anti-Pahlavi sentiments. The sceptical Iranian public interpreted the change in tone as proof that Reza Shah was no longer in control, even as a presumption that he was no longer a useful puppet in the hand of his British masters. Resentful of British machinations, real and imagined, some openly sympathized with the Axis and their advances on the Russian front. Bewildered and demoralized, the Shah too felt that he was caught in the middle of a deadly conflict with no certain end. The endgame came in a crushing order that started with the Allied ultimatum and Iranian appeasement in July 1941, and ended in a checkmate that removed Reza Shah less than 2 months later. Demanding expulsion of all Germans from Iran and abdication of Reza Shah, both obvious ploys to facilitate the joint invasion of Iran, the Allies appeared uncompromising from the outset. The Iranian government tried in vain to satisfy the Allies' demands, not only to expel all German nationals, but also to provide full access to the Iranian road and railroad network to transport cargo, military hardware, and supplies across Iranian territory and through the Caspian and the Caucasus to the besieged Red Army in Stalingrad and on other fronts. In a faint hope of saving Iran from another invasion, the government of Ali Mansour, barely free of Reza Shah's iron fist, agreed to most of the terms. The two powers were to benefit free and unconditional access of the same rail network that they, Britain and Russia, had prevented Iran from constructing for more than half a century. They were about to depose the person who built it and occupy a nation that paid for the railroad through taxes on sugar and tea. Before negotiations could come to any conclusion, on August 25, 1941, the coordinated Allied armies marched into Iran through its northern and southern borders. The two powers did not even declare war or serve any other notice to the Iranian government. A sheer display of force, tinged with a dose of colonial conceit, was meant to deliver the message. It also implied that occupation was not an act of aggression, but a wartime contingency. Facing the overwhelming superiority of the Allied forces, the demoralized and ill-prepared Iranian army soon caved, and shortly after, almost completely dissipated. The Red Army took over the whole of Azerbaijan and the Caspian provinces and rallied toward Tehran, while the British Indian forces crossing the frontiers in southern Iraq and entering through the Persian Gulf ports rushed in the same direction. Allied air forces began bombing civilian and military targets in major cities, causing havoc and undermining civilian confidence, while leaflets dropped from the air spoke of the occupiers' benevolence, friendship toward the Iranian people, and desire to leave Iranian territory at the close of the war. The small Iranian navy in the Persian Gulf offered a heroic resistance, only to be soundly crushed. The sizable army, on the other hand, abandoned the lines of defence or surrendered. An effort to organise the defence of the capital failed, and even senior officers deserted, leaving thousands of starving conscripts to slowly head home to their towns and villages. Since the turn of the 19th century, this was the seventh time the frontiers of Iran had been violated by one or both of the European powers. On the same day of the invasion, in an audience at dawn with Reza Shah, requested by the British and Soviet envoys, they repeated demands for the expulsion of all Germans and for unconditional access to Iranian railroads and roads. The Shah had no choice but to comply with a fait accompli. The envoy's real intent, however, came in a subsequent communique demanding the immediate abdication of Reza Pahlavi, with the assurance that his son Mohammad Reza would replace him. Under Allied pressure, a new government was formed by the elderly statesman Mohammad Ali Farooqi, who was brought out of retirement to undertake a formidable task. In the midst of panic and confusion, Farooqi, in a public announcement, assured the public that the Allied occupation was transient and declared the cessation of hostilities, which in effect put the final touch on the dismantling of the Iranian armed forces. The Shah's abdication seemed inevitable. It is startling how quickly the forces of chaos set in. The ensuing tribal unrest, economic havoc, and public panic caused by food shortages and fears of starvation were compounded by the uncouth conduct of the Indian Army's sepoys and the Red Army's tavarishes, as well as by the prospect of the Allied march on the capital. The Shah's plea, telegraphed to President Franklin Roosevelt, proved to be of no avail. Yet the Shah's customary wrath had not diminished completely. In the last meeting with his army command, he showered invectives on all for destroying an army he had built up for over 2 decades and physically beat up the chief of staff for cowardly conduct. He ordered the army commanders to be detained on the charge of treason and to stand a military trial, which in the end was never held. On September 3, 1941, while the people of Iran were hearing on the newly established Radio Iran the still unbelievable news that Reza Shah had abdicated, he was on his way to Isfahan, where he was to be united with his family. On September 16, after formally abdicating the throne, the Shah and his family departed from the port of Bandar Abbas aboard a British postal ship to an undisclosed destination. The most that Reza Shah could secure from the Allies, through the good offices of Furughi, was the promise of his elder son's succession, an issue briefly debated by the British in favour of a Qajar prince, but then quietly set aside. On September 26, while the Allied forces were establishing their headquarters on the outskirts of the Iranian capital, the 22-year-old Crown Prince Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, 1919-1980, was sworn in as Iran's new constitutional monarch. In less than 3 months, the reign of the once invulnerable Reza Shah came to an ignominious end. After a brief stay on the Indian Ocean island of Mauritius, then a British possession, Reza Shah and his family were transferred to Johannesburg in the British colony of South Africa, where they lived a life of seclusion destined for many former foes of the empire. 2 years later, on July 26, 1944, Reza Shah died at the age of 67 of a heart ailment. In his last photographs, he is in a civilian suit, a notable contrast to his lifelong public appearances in military uniform, a broken man, humiliated, and visibly aged. His coffin was sent to Cairo, where it was temporarily buried in the crypt of the Rifa'i Mosque, and later brought back to Iran in May 1950, to be buried in an impressive mausoleum built near the shrine of Abdelazim in southern Tehran. A career in the balance. The downfall of Reza Shah came at the end of a career of contested legacies. Perhaps the most influential ruler in Iranian history since Ismail I in the early 16th century, he was instrumental in carrying out massive changes that transformed Iranian society, culture, and economy. He has been remembered as a man of vision and resolve, but also as autocratic, avaricious, and increasingly paranoid. With the benefit of hindsight, he may be seen as the most realistic option for Iran in the post-World War I era, a leader who reasserted sovereignty and carried out nearly all the non-political objectives of the constitutional revolution. He and his cohorts created a centralized state with modern institutions, infrastructure, education, and improved health, new industries, and modern finances. The Pahlavi order engendered an optimistic sense of national identity that revolved around cultural heritage, collective memory, and national symbols. It put an end to the political impasse in the center and pacified Iran, albeit with brute force, and helped the rise of a new middle class. It increased government revenue and efficiency, and restrained foreign influences in domestic affairs. It curbed the power of tribal leaders, checked the conservative clergy, and lessened, if not demolished, the long-held monopoly of the Qajar ruling elite. Reza Shah's successes came at a high price. Despite his emphasis on institutional modernization, as in finances, judiciary, and education, and despite a semblance of cultural modernity, the reforms of the Pahlavi period remained decidedly lopsided. The agrarian economy, still the largest economic sector, remained essentially intact, and the landowning culture of exploitation was reinforced by Reza Shah's own greed. He built a vast estate through brazen appropriation of the lands belonging to Mozandaran's small and large landowners. The industrialization and trade policies relied heavily on government monopolies and state ownership, at the expense of fostering an expansive industrial bourgeoisie. The hasty introduction of new secularized institutions, with few exceptions, was marked by uncritical borrowing of Western models and misconceived positivist values, and it was often combined with contempt for Iran's indigenous traditions and cultural mores. The nationalist ideology of the Pahlavi era, too, tended to undermine Iran's ethnic and linguistic diversity and to accommodate Iran's long and complex Shi'i past. Yet the budding aspirations of the constitutional period for democracy and popular representation were not completely crushed. Iranians received the news of Reza Shah's ouster with a mix of indignation, for it came with yet another foreign intrusion, and with relief, ending an era of political repression. Soon after his death, however, ordinary people remembered Reza Shah more for his transforming reforms than his police apparatus. Yet Pahlavi absolutism was far less loyal to the checks and balances that, under the rubric of the Circle of Equity, had for centuries kept the Persian kingship in a functional relationship with the society over which it ruled. The two arms of the traditional state, the executive, consisting of the Divan and the army, no longer were kept at bay, and the judiciary, consisting of the clerical establishment, had no place in the structure of power. One can attribute the rise of the new culture of unbridled autocracy under Reza Shah above all to the environment of frustration and insecurity that thrived in the post-constitutional era. This spirit of militarism was reinforced after the virtual collapse of the Qajar social contract and during World War I. Reza Shah, in effect, stood at the pinnacle of a power pyramid that, with shrewd manoeuvring, had incorporated an assortment of the existing military forces and glued them together by appropriating a large chunk of Iran's oil revenue. The military culture that came to dominate the new Pahlavi armed forces was the despotic ethos of the Russian Cossack barracks in which Reza Khan and his senior officers had been trained. The nationalistic ideals of a few gendarmerie officers who joined the Pahlavi army and the more familiar rough-and-ready conduct of the officers of the regular Iranian armed forces, who also were incorporated, both had their part in the shaping of the Pahlavi military elite. Even some of the civilians in Reza Shah's service, such as Temurtash, were graduates of European military academies. The German and Turkish officers, who in the course of the World War I came into contact with their Iranian counterparts, mostly the Iranian gendarmes, also conveyed a much-admired spirit of Prussian military. That such an authoritarian model prevailed in Europe after World War I and brought to power fascist regimes resonated with the Pahlavi regime, as in Italy, Germany, and the Soviet Union, and to some degree in the early Turkish Republic. In Iran, too, the new ethos quickly overcame the democratic ideals of constitution, division of powers, popular representation, rule of law, and individual rights. In Iran, arguably, there were even more causes for this shift of paradigm, given all that was experienced by Iranians in the period between 1907 and 1921, with disarray in majlis and incapacitated post-constitutional governments, persistence of the old elite and their feeble governance, foreign occupation, and the economic and human prices that society endured. It was from this milieu that emerged a culture of empowerment well reflected in military uniforms, shiny riding boots, ready-to-use riding crops, rough tone of speech, and harsh treatment of inferiors. The sense of superiority that the ranking officer under Reza Shah came to display, and the proud esprit de corps that held them together as a new privileged class, proved more potent than shaky political parties, daring journalism, moving poems, and fiery speeches from the pulpit of the mosques and the podium of the majlis.